You're listening to Radio Hangar Aviation Talk, powered by AI, fueled by passion. Welcome to the hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and friends, I have been waiting to tell this one. Pour yourself another cup of coffee, settle into that lawn chair, because today we are talking about the man that Jimmy Doolittle himself called the greatest stick and rudder pilot who ever lived. We're talking about Robert A. Hoover, Bob Hoover, and if you've ever seen him fly, you already know. And if you haven't, well, that's what I'm here for. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, gear, apparel, and gifts for people who live and breathe aviation. If you've got Avgas in your veins, they've got something for you. Check them out. Now here's where it gets interesting, because Bob Hoover's story doesn't start at an air show. It starts in a German prison camp. It's 1944. Hoover is a young fighter pilot, flying Spitfires with the 52nd Fighter Group out of North Africa. On his 59th mission, his aircraft takes damage and he goes down. The Germans capture him and send him to Stalag Luft 1, a prisoner of war camp near the Baltic coast. Now, most men would have spent the rest of the war sitting in that camp. Bob Hoover was not most men. He escaped. And here's the part that still gives me chills. He stole a Focke-Wulf 190, a German fighter, an airplane he had never flown, never sat in, never even studied the cockpit layout of. He figured it out on the spot, got it started, got it in the air, and flew it to safety in the Netherlands. Think about that for a second. You're malnourished. You're exhausted. You're a fugitive behind enemy lines. And you climb into an enemy aircraft with placards you can't read, instruments calibrated in metrics you don't know, and you fly it home. That right there tells you everything about the kind of pilot Bob Hoover was. Instinct, feel, an understanding of flight that went past language and past labels on a panel. After the war, Hoover became a test pilot. He flew chase plane for Chuck Yeager on the day. Yeager broke the sound barrier in the Bell X-1 in 1947. Hoover was right there, tucked in beside that little orange rocket ship over the high desert at Muroc, which we now call Edwards Air Force Base. He went on to test fly practically everything North American aviation built. The F-86 Sabre, the F-100 Super Sabre, aircraft that were pushing the edge of what we understood about flight, but it was the air show circuit where Bob Hoover became a legend. And I mean legend in the truest sense of that word, his routine. Let me try to paint this picture for you. He'd come out in a Rockwell Shrike Commander, a twin-engine business airplane, nothing exotic, nothing with a radial engine shaking the fillings out of your teeth. Just a plain everyday twin, yellow and green paint job, and the crowd would be thinking, okay, what's this all about? Then he'd shut down one engine, and he'd do a loop, a roll, an 8-point roll, on one engine in a Shrike Commander. Now the crowd is paying attention. Then he'd shut down the other engine, both engines off, dead quiet, nothing but the sound of wind over wings, and Bob Hoover would perform a full aerobatic sequence in a twin-engine airplane with no power whatsoever. Loops, rolls, wingovers. He'd manage that energy like a miser counting pennies. Every foot of altitude was currency, and he spent it with absolute precision. And here was the finale. He'd come around on a dead stick approach, both propellers just windmilling, and he would touch down on the runway, roll out to the crowd line, and come to a stop. Then he'd pour himself a glass of iced tea from a pitcher he kept in the cockpit. Not a drop spilled, that was the exclamation point. That glass of tea was his way of saying, I had so much control over this airplane, so much margin, that this was never in doubt, not for one second. I saw him do that routine at Oshkosh in the early 90s. I was standing on the flight line with about 50,000 other people, and when both those engines went quiet, you could hear the crowd hold its breath. That silence, that eerie, beautiful silence of an airplane doing things it wasn't designed to do, with a man at the controls who understood flight the way a poet understands language. It wasn't mechanical, it was art. Now pull up a chair because I want to talk about the Mustang. Hoover also flew a P-51 Mustang he called Ole Yeller, bright yellow paint, and if the Shrike Commander routine was about precision and subtlety, Ole Yeller was about thunder. He'd come across the field inverted, maybe 50 feet off the deck, that Merlin engine howling, and pull into a climbing roll that seemed to go on forever. He flew that Mustang the way it was meant to be flown. Aggressive. Confident. But always with this grace that set him apart from every other warbird pilot on the circuit. There was never a wasted movement. Never a moment where you thought, oh, he's a little wide on that one, or he's a little low. Every pass, every pull, every roll was exactly where it needed to be. I talked to a fellow once, an old North American test pilot, who told me that Hoover could feel turbulence through the seat of his pants that most pilots couldn't detect on instruments. He said Bob didn't fly airplanes so much as he wore them, like the aircraft was an extension of his body. And you know that tracks with something Hoover himself used to say. He said, fly the airplane as far into the crash as possible, meaning never give up, never stop flying, there's always something you can do. That philosophy came from experience. In his career, Hoover survived multiple engine failures, control malfunctions, and at least two crashes that should have killed him. One time during a test flight in an F-100, the flight controls locked up and he rode that airplane into the ground, broke his back, nearly died, came back and kept flying.
The man was indestructible and fearless, but not reckless. There's an important distinction there. Hoover knew exactly where the edge was, because he'd been there so many times. He operated right at that edge, but he never crossed it. Not at an air show. Not with a crowd watching. Now I have to talk about the dark chapter, because it's part of the story. In 1992, the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, pulled Bob Hoover's medical certificate. They said he was unfit to fly. He was in his early 70s at the time, and by all accounts still flying with the same precision he always had. The airshow community was outraged. Pilots from all over the world rallied behind him. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, actually overruled the FAA and ordered his medical reinstated. It was one of the only times that had ever happened. Hoover got his certificate back, and he went right back to the airshow circuit and kept flying for several more years after that. But it left a mark on him. He wrote about it in his autobiography, called Forever Flying. Said it was the hardest fight of his life, harder than the prison camp, harder than the test flights, because they were trying to take away the thing that defined him. And that's something every pilot can understand. Flying isn't just what we do, it's who we are. You take that away, and you take away a piece of the person. Bob Hoover passed away on October 25, 2016. He was 94 years old, and the tributes that poured in from every corner of aviation told you everything you needed to know about what this man meant to the flying world. Sean Tucker, one of the greatest airshow pilots of the next generation, said that everything he knew about energy management he learned from watching Bob Hoover. Patty Wagstaff said he was the standard against which all airshow pilots measured themselves. The Experimental Aircraft Association, or EAA, dedicated an entire exhibit to him at the museum in Oshkosh. But I think the tribute that matters most is the one you hear in every hangar, at every fly-in, at every grass strip breakfast where old pilots gather. Someone always brings up Bob Hoover. Someone always tells the story about the iced tea. Someone always shakes their head and says there'll never be another one like him. And they're right, there won't be. Because Bob Hoover came from a time when test pilots wrote the manual as they went, when the envelope wasn't just pushed, it was folded into a paper airplane and thrown off a cliff. He bridged the gap between the barnstormers and the jet age. He took a plain twin-engine business airplane and turned it into a magic carpet. He took a Mustang and made it sing. He showed us what was possible when a human being and a machine become one thing. One beautiful, soaring, improbable thing. And every time I see a Shrike Commander parked on a ramp somewhere, I smile, because I know what that airplane can do in the right hands. Sources for today's show include Bob Hoover's autobiography Forever Flying, historical archives from the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, reporting from the EAA and Air and Space magazine, and a whole lot of hangar flying conversations over the years with folks who saw the man fly in person. As always, Radio Hangar is an AI-generated program built by folks who love aviation, and we credit our sources because that's how it ought to be done. You can find more about the show at radiohangar.com. That's it for today, friends. If you ever get the chance to watch old footage of Bob Hoover flying that Shrike Commander, do yourself a favor, find it, watch it, watch it again, and remember that a man once made a business airplane dance on nothing but dead air and skill. Fly safe, fly often, and never stop learning from the ones who came before us. Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.